for a couple of months now, we've been talking initially based in looking at the Diamond Sutra and then somewhat more broadly about bodhisattva practice, which is a way of talking about the weave between spiritual practice as a personal or individual seeking or unwinding, and relationship, meaning community, meaning the world we live in, meaning action and its effects. And at the heart of this conversation about bodhisattva practice that we got to last week, a first touch into a perspective on practice that sees the individual as only one aspect of our identity or our action in the world, and that we could just as easily think of ourselves, think of the self as centered in or occupied by different kinds of groups of people. One can think of the family as having a kind of self or an identity, that the family is actually a singular being in a certain way moving through the world, and that there are aspects then of experience that are the experience of families as a class of people rather than as individuals. Even if every individual has a different experience of something, there are aspects of identity and life in the world that are shared and that don't make sense if transposed from the family to the individual, for instance, that there's simply family karma. Likewise, there's karma or momentums of action, aspects of identity that live at the community level, at the cultural level, and really at the grandest sense of ourselves and our world, the ecosystem level, of deep biological or physiological or everythingological interconnection. We opened into this model as a way to start talking about social justice a bit and social action. And I used last week race as an example of how racial identity or racial ideas, as one very charged trope or aspect of experience at the moment in our culture, in the world culture right now, how our experience of race is different depending on which of these circles or which of these aspects of our identity we are connecting with at any given moment. And the aspect of this theory or this presentation that is often both most compelling and most challenging for folks is the sense that there are karmas or aspects of experience that are held by, for instance, a collective of people rather than by an individual. And so, you know, the very charged examples right now, for instance, in relation to race, are, you know, would be to name something like white supremacy, which as a set of ideas may or may not be held in a strict way by any particular individual who bears the physiology of whiteness, but which is held by a collective of people who bear those marks, that physiology, even those who oppose it carry that karma. So that and we got into just hinted at the beginnings of conversations that are happening around in the social action world right now, a little bit around like, where do you place responsibility or blame or historical weight on a thing? In other words, you know, a well-intentioned anti-white supremacy white person right now still bears white privilege as they move through the world. And therefore, even if their personal wish is to dismantle this overarching oppression structure, they still carry the karma of being on the privileged or safer or oppressor side of that dynamic, even if they don't individually believe it. So that would be like a an aspect of structure that's held at the communal or even the cultural level. And what gets to be challenging about this is that individual people then both have a personal responsibility to be awake to the karma of their particular set or sets that they belong to, right? I bear the karma of men, regardless of how much I identify with men as a set, unless I cross the line out of identifying with that set. And those cases are complex in other ways, ways that you choose or do not choose to be a member of or not a member of a given set of people. But there's a lot of confusion often around, for instance, like, what should I take as my own responsibility? You know, is it my fault, for instance, as a member of an oppressor class, that other members of that oppressor class have acted badly? Right? And it takes some delicacy to parse, really, in our own process, how I'm both separate from those, from people from my set who have oppressed, but I still am a member of that set and therefore responsible to the actions that appear to be centered in the set rather than individuals. Does that make sense? If we think about stereotypes, we point to it, right? We could all think about stereotypes that say, like, men behave these ways, or white people behave these ways, or, you know, folks of a particular group behave these ways. The stereotypes are always wrong as a definition of any individual person's action, right? They're either sort of statistically accurate but individually wrong, or they're not even statistically accurate. Like, they could be completely wrong, but they've become a sort of cultural idea. But once that happens, every individual is subject to that idea, regardless of their own actions and relationship to it. And so this is a challenging one to figure out. How much am I responsible to, and how much am I not? And this really hinges on a core Buddhist concept that I think is both the result of engaging in this inquiry and the prerequisite for engaging in it successfully. And unfortunately, it's one of the most difficult concepts in the Buddhist system, which is the concept of selflessness or anatta, not having an individual or separate essence. And so the basic teaching goes something like this. If you investigate your experience, what you find is a constantly fluctuating process where sensations and thoughts and feelings and experiences and communication of various kinds comes and goes all the time, always changes. Even when it seems to be related to something that happened before, it's still a little bit different. If you were to look at that constantly changing experience and look for a stable or solid eternal essence that is you, that you could own and act from and be in control of and be in a way that was beyond change. That thing that in the West we might call a soul or an absolute essence of you that's eternal. The Buddhist inquiry says, look for that. Look for it because implicit in our lives and our relationships and in our grasping to things is a belief that there is that thing. We think that there is that, therefore I have to protect it, therefore I have to get it certain experiences so it'll be happy. Therefore, it's mine and it's unique, therefore it's different from others, therefore there's always difference from others. All of those belief systems, everything that gives rise both to wholesome relationship and unwholesome relationship, but particularly of concern here is unwholesome relationship because suffering. All of that is built on perceiving a solid, personal, separate, essential self when one can't actually be found. And this proposal is frightening sometimes. You know, really, especially when we find ourselves in a situation or state where there's been significant distress or trauma or challenge, where, like, I'm just trying to hold on to a basic sense of who I am in the world. The world is hard enough. That illusion isn't just a casual, like, oh, yeah, I just happened to be going along believing in a separate self. It was more like, you know, it's the core of my being to believe that I am an individual in that particular way. And when that slips, what does it even mean to be healthy or sane or successful or in the world? If I take out the idea that there's a singular being to whom all of these experiences are happening. But until I let go of that idea as a fixed aspect of my, you know, perspective, deeper change in the direction of liberation and happiness simply isn't possible. Like, at some point, I can get healthier and healthier, doing well, but not too far down that road of doing okay do I run into this challenge of, like, what's actually happening here? What am I doing with all of this, like, being well, trying to? It's like, oh, okay, I had one of those, like, glorious periods of my life. Maybe it was a weekend, maybe it was a couple of years, who knows, where I was healthy and strong and happy and there was enough resources and I was creative and all that, everything sort of came together. And am I just going to be like, aha, I've made it. Done. Now it will be like this forever. Ha. Right? Like, oh wait, no, that was just a weekend. And, you know, it's like, oh, I had an extra day off work and I stayed hydrated. Therefore, it was the best weekend of my life, essentially. Mm-hmm. Like, the conditions are so fragile that create that sense of profound well-being. And if it sustains for even a handful of days, the joy in it does not sustain, right? You notice it fluctuates. You're like, oh, well, now I'm bored, or now I'm excited, and I start to get creative, but then the doubt comes. And it's a little bit like we nurture this communal delusion that the best it can possibly be is pretty good in a tolerable way. Like, there's enough pleasures that, you know. But there's just this acknowledgement that, like, well, yeah, but then there's still, you know, doubt and dissatisfaction and overwhelm and all of those things. You know, or we fetishize a kind of perfect life, and we're like, oh, well, if I could be like Wendell Berry or whoever your person is, you know, if I could just, like, own some land, write a few books, have a little passive income, retire with some goats, then I would just be, like, done and happy, you know. And I know those people, and they're complaining, right? It's like, you know. So it turns out that holding on to the idea that everything that's happening to you and in the world is in relation to this fixed, separate, singular identity that is you, it turns out that having that as the pillar of your life means that suffering is always the experience. That one that is separate can never be safe, can never actually be at home or find a true refuge, because it's always going to be isolated. It's always going to be subject to gain and loss, to birth and death. Literally and metaphorically. And so then, you know, even to come towards social action, social justice, bodhisattva practice, there's actually no way to have any perspective on something like a systemic demon, like racism or sexism, patriarchy. Without being able to let go a little bit of the blinders of the isolated individual. And this is part of why in political discourse in this country, conversations about like individual rights and being not subject to anyone and perspectives that are hostile to many kinds of social action, social uplift, come together. That actually radical individualism and opposing action in relation to social justice often come together because social justice action, social action is so commonly, almost always really framed around improving the structural conditions for entire classes of people. We should make it better for, you know, the folks in this country who are the descendants of the African slave trade. Or we should make it better in this country for folks who appear to be or identify as women. In basic structural ways, you know, women should earn the same per hour as men, et cetera, for work. All of the basics of discrimination. And the arguments against that very often make the category error, I'll propose, of confusing the group for the individual. Where like, oh, well, there's lots of individual privileged women or wealthy black folks or any number of things you could come up with. Of course there are. That doesn't mean that as a class there isn't oppression, even if any particular individual has their own distinct story. From a Buddhist perspective then, from the perspective of the Mahayana or the Bodhisattva orientation, remember that the intention of the Bodhisattva is to save all beings. But they do that in part by realizing or remembering or not getting lost in relation to individuals. Bodhisattvas remember that there's no such thing as individuals to be saved. What if we frame that in terms of, let's say, you know, justice around race in this moment and say, you know, bodhisattvas vow to end racism while understanding that there are no individuals who are racist or who receive the results of racism. That's a challenging thing to say. Individuals receive the results all the time, but not because of their individuality. The whole point of a systemic demon is that it dispenses oppression. Indiscriminately or you know, generously to everyone who falls within that class or even appears to fall within that class. That's why it's a systemic harm rather than a personal one. It's why the solutions to it or the conversation around it inevitably falls back at a certain point to stereotypes and generalizations, you know. How do you actually assert something in a culture that relates to an entire class of people without, in a certain way, having to blur all those people into one thing? This was a huge argument in the 1970s and early 80s in some feminist communities oriented toward feminist action, because some kinds of feminism in relation to women's liberation seemed to depend on holding an essentialized idea of what woman means. But then if you come in with a different feminist trope that would assert that actually essentialized ideas about what women are is a form of oppression itself. Women are radically different from each other. And it would come down to like, yeah, there's actually oppression in relation to generalizing women's experience into an entire class. There's all sorts of problems with that. There's also an oppression that comes when that unity is abandoned in favor of the sense that every single story is different. So in general, anti-oppression movements have to use some amount of essentializing, which is always going to be basically an error on one level. But we can see it as an expression that there are certain kinds of karma that play out at the communal level and certain kinds of karma that play out at the individual level. And they're just different. They're related and interwoven, but different. And the hinge for all of this in Buddhist practice is selflessness. If there actually was a separate, eternal individual in each being, then in a sense, that separateness would outweigh communalness, right? If you were a separate, eternal individual, then the particular group of beings that you happened to fall into in this cultural moment, it would matter relatively less than your eternal identity, if that's something that lasts, and we're really talking eternal here, like beyond the life of this body, right? Which is true in all of the great religions. If you're Christian, you get reborn once. If you're Buddhist or Hindu, you get reborn lots of times, but you get reborn in both of those in a way that's, you know, who you are, whatever that means, continues after the death of the body. The only way out of it, one of the popular ways out of it right now, is to deny the continuity of anything past the body. This was a position the Buddhist texts would just call nihilism. That to assert that, like, this is only a physical phenomenon and the sense of the self is just a byproduct of the complexity of a system, and at the end of this life there's nothing to sustain, it just ends. I actually think that's a fine position. It's logically defensible, which one likes sometimes. The trouble with it in a certain way is that if you take it to its logical conclusion, it makes actions relatively meaningless. Which again is okay philosophically, but doesn't sit right emotionally and spiritually. It doesn't feel like emotions are meaningless, even though logically I could say this body is just a byproduct of biological conditions, the mind is a byproduct of biological conditions. If that were the case, we were able to rest into that as, like, that's how it is, you know, what would the implications be? Like, murder and suicide would not be a big deal because it doesn't really matter. Like, it doesn't sit. So that wasn't the conclusion. There were sages at the time of the Buddha who took that conclusion, who actually preached that nothing continues. There's no permanence, therefore there's no discipline structures, there's no ethical structures. The universe is not an ethical system. Harm doesn't matter, basically. And the Buddha categorically said that was wrong view. That was an inappropriate interpretation of experience. So then what we can lean into is an understanding of social action that doesn't depend on the fantasy, even if it's quite subconscious, of the individual hero, where, you know, I as an individual marshal whatever resources and disciplines that I have, and I heal my own life. I uproot racism from my own actions and speech, and I, you know, recycle everything and don't fly, do whatever, everything I do to perfect my individual karma. And I could do that, but, you know, and then, like, oh, there's some idea that, like, oh, if I get all of this really clear, I do all my therapy, I get all of my intentions in order, then I could, you know, be a great activist in the world and help people and start organizations and bring a lot of well-being to the world. And all of that's possible. But it all depends, and I think ultimately breaks down around the perception that there's an individual heroic being doing it. And the Bodhisattva texts knew this from the very beginning, like individual heroic beings can't save the world. There's this beautiful story of the Bodhisattva dedicated to compassion named Avalokiteshvara, is the Sanskrit or Tibetan name, Sanskrit and Indian name. Chenrezig is the Tibetan name, and the same being is Kuan Yin in the Chinese systems. Kuan Yin and related to Kanzeon in the Japanese systems. So this one idea of a kind of semi-divine, essentially, being oriented toward compassion. The name Avalokiteshvara means the one who hears the cries of the world while resting at ease. And Quan Shuyin in the Chinese. So one of the many stories about the origin of this being is that there was a great practitioner who had made the vow to save all beings, and particularly the people of Tibet, the nomadic herding people with their particular suffering. And so this being entered deep retreat for a vast period of time, and deep in samadhi, cultivating the spiritual power and force to be able to radiate compassion and save beings from suffering. And this being vowed, when they entered their samadhi and their training, that they would practice for 10 years and realize the end of suffering for all beings within those 10 years. And if they failed to do that, that they would immediately die upon the end of the retreat. Don't make that vow in your retreat. Don't do it. But this is the teaching story that tells you not to do it. So Avalokiteshvara goes into retreat, listens to the cries of the world, radiates infinite compassion in all directions, and rests in the clear light of the mind, soaked with empathy and compassion, care for beings. And many beings are saved just by, when someone does this, it's awesome, right, for the world. But after 10 years, Avalokiteshvara gets up from meditation, stretches their legs, goes out to the ledge in front of the cave, one imagines, and looks out over the world with the divine eye that is purified, so with some supernatural power, and sees, of course, that all beings have not been saved, that there's still so much suffering, greed and hatred and delusion. And the realization that no matter that how successful they were or powerful in their practice they were, that they had not been able to accomplish this. And the earlier vow that they would do so made this being explode into 1,000 pieces and just shatter all over the landscape. And I like shatter in a certain way because there's a kind of brittleness to making that vow. And so shatter feels right. So all the shards of Avalokiteshvara are shining on the mesa. And then one of the gods comes down, and I don't remember in the Tibetan story who it is. It might have been Sakha, the king of the gods, who often plays this role, comes down and says, Avaloyu, that wasn't the right vow. Like, it can't be done. But good practice, good going. And reassembled Avalokiteshvara into a being that has 1,000 heads that look in all directions and see everywhere, and 1,000 arms and hands, and an eye in the center of each palm. And so this radiance, this sort of halo of hands and arms and eyes to see suffering everywhere and to have 1,000 hands to reach out and help and serve. A being, a radiance serving and seeing being. So then you see the images of this standing figure surrounded by hands with eyes. It's an incredible image of the state of a vast, externally focused, radiantly focused, all the eyes are open. Compassion and action, the hands are open. Right? It's not a meditating figure. So And then the same being becomes, in Chinese culture, Kuan Yin, same qualities, same name. It's just a translation of the name. So, you know, the individual wish, I will save beings, I will save the ecosystem, I will save our culture, is doomed to failure. But the practice proposes this profound different perspective through this foundational inquiry into the self. And it turns out in this amazing way that if I don't exist, haven't ever existed, in the way that I think I do exist, but not in the way that the constricted, in a certain way, narcissism, like the error of constantly interpreting experience through the lens of myself, that error prevents me from being able to help beings, because I'm always helping them through the lens of, like, well, how is this for me? And so insight into anatta, which comes through practice, when I see in a steady and ongoing way that the whole play of experience just can't be myself. Even the feeling of being myself comes and goes. How could it be really me if it comes and goes? Actually, there's nothing I can find. Even awareness itself fluctuates. What am I then? And the beautiful, radical insight of bodhisattva practice is that based in that, the emptiness of the self, based in that perspective, a vastness of view becomes possible that actually can act and respond to and be, can perceive that which is true on the larger levels of, say existence itself or ecosystem. But then in relation to our conversation about social justice, I would say this is actually a perspective that really serves looking at something like systemic racism or patriarchy. Get myself out of the way, and first of all, there's no one here to be defensive or offensive, around it. The understanding becomes clearer, and then the hope in Dharma practice certainly is that, the promise really of Dharma practice is that as understanding becomes clearer, action will necessarily follow. Because understanding always arises within the wish for well-being. This is, the Buddha actually proposes that the universe is moral at its heart, that there's an instinct toward preservation of life or preservation of goodness, and even more deeply, an instinct toward liberation and the conditions that support liberation, and that's a good thing, you know, or to say it differently, it doesn't have to be a good thing, it's just what is. This is the law of karma. Karma is a natural law. And this one, I'll talk about this on the Ethics Day long at Spirit Rock. This one is challenging because modern scientific humanism, because it had to rebel so hard against religion in Europe, it swung toward a kind of morally relativistic universe. You know, where ethics matter on the level of culture, but not beyond that. And the Indian conception of dharma as duty or moral law or how the world functions as a system didn't make the same conclusion, and actually understood that if actions and their effects is what's always happening, the only meaningful criteria to judge our experience by is the causing of harm or the non-causing of harm. And so the thing that if the whole universe were a computer or a computing device made entirely of zeros and ones, right? Form and formlessness, or you know, existence and non-existence, or anything and its opposite. If that's how everything is, and that's one good model for how things are, a vast, hyper-complex web of binaries, then the fundamental binary actually is the moral binary, is help versus harm. And everything else is in a way secondary to that. So take a moment before we open for questions. And the practices in relation to anatta are subtle. Mostly they consist of reflections. But the reflection is something like this. Without meditating or needing to change anything about what you're doing right now, just notice the web of what's happening. There's information coming in through your senses, there's understanding in the mind, through language, through concept, through relationship. And there's, within all of that information, one of the pieces of information that's coming is the felt sense of being a self. I just feel like myself. And the beginnings to unpacking that self is to actually tune into that felt sense. It's see if you can actually contact it. What's it like to just know in this moment that you're you, or to assume that you are you, with your particular story, your traumas, your successes, your privileges, the various classes of being that you belong to, the uniqueness of you? Can you perceive that as a felt sense? And if you can, and it's subtle, it's completely in the background, right? It's a little bit like saying, you know, to a fish, notice the water. But you can do it. It's Buddha's fish, they notice the water. And you have to tune into something that's mostly always there. One of the great ways you can tune into it is to remember moments when it wasn't. Moments when you forgot yourself in a moment of ecstatic relationship with another, or a moment of deep darkness in your life, depression or loss. A moment where you felt connected to something bigger than yourself, a big movement. It's not about you, it's just about, you know, 50,000 people in the streets. That's a moment when you might be like, oh, that thing where I feel myself as a separate individual, that fluctuates. So play with that for a moment and see if you can actually get the sense, the felt sense, that this thing that seems so solid, I, me, mine, that thing is a phenomena based in conditions. Those conditions can change. And when the conditions change, the experience changes. And just see what happens as you do that. Remember that anything you think about it, or any thoughts, or anywhere your mind or heart goes, is just more phenomena. And the sense of having a self, what it does is it habitually takes ownership of those things, of my thoughts, my story, my concerns with this, whatever. And the practice is relentless in its simplicity. Take even those things as more transient phenomena. Everything that feels like me is a feeling that comes and goes. That's all. And this is not to minimize it. There's so much there. All of culture and art and so much is there. But it's not the only thing. time for responses, questions, curiosities. Where do you go with it? Or what happens in your practice as we touch into this realm?
The last part that you were mentioning about like feeling like yourself, and if you don't know what that feels like, think about a time when you didn't feel like yourself.
Yeah.
I chuckled because the first class I came to this one, I think was like the first one of 2018, and you may have asked like, what's one of your goals for the year? What would you like to get out of this class? Mm-hmm. And I distinctly remember I said, I want to feel like myself again.
Feel myself again, yeah. Right on.
Yeah.
There you go.
It was just a funny little moment.
Mm-hmm. We'll just loop back to that one through the back door, the other side. One of the things, of course, that's so important and always true about this is that if the feeling of not feeling like yourself has been strong in your life, then the moments when you do feel like yourself are important, right? Like it's, you can't go from having a fractured sense of self to connecting joyfully in an interconnected way with others, because there's a kind of, it's almost like there's a coherence of being that comes first from resting for some time in a healthy, you know, consolidated sense of myself. It's necessary in a violent world to have that, to know that. And without that strength, actually, spiritual practice doesn't really progress. I'm trying to see through myself, but mostly I'm processing trauma. So feeling like myself again is absolutely necessary. And then if you just keep that wish forever, basically, say that every year, you know, at a certain point, you'll feel like yourself a lot, but that wish will end up pointing towards something else. I want to feel like my truer self. What is my deeper self? And so even starting there, it'll lead you all the way if you keep the inquiry alive. But welcome back, and good going. How's the year been?
Yeah, feeling a little more like myself.
Yeah, awesome, awesome. Yeah, may it continue. Yeah, please.
So when you were talking about kind of noticing that the thickness and thinness, so you didn't use that language, but of self.
Mm-hmm. And you I like that language, though.
And you said thinking about times when you didn't feel like yourself, and you mentioned depression. And it's interesting because I think about times when I was depressed, and it's true, I didn't quite feel like myself, but at the same time, it felt like the sense of self was very thick.
Yeah, for sure.
Because it was just so immersed in my world.
Yeah.
And so yeah, I'm just kind of curious about that. But simultaneously, it's like a tension there.
There is. I wonder if a distinction I would make between like the kind of, you know, depression or deep internal distress that is that's really working fight and flight actively. So I'm kind of churning with the energy of myself in relationship to difficulty. And kind of, it's a little more the anxiety side than the depressive side, but they're so often interwoven. The depressive is kind of this cycle of the same kind of thought, you know, again and again, and it is self-focused. Mm-hmm. Versus the kind of depression that's more on the freeze spectrum, where it's kind of dissociative, mm-hmm. where I'm sort of just like blank, but maybe open, but like I don't really know who I am or what I'm doing, and I'm kind of numb in a certain way. Mm-hmm. That kind of painful state can have not much of a sense of self in it. It can be kind of like, well, you know, I don't know, I could kind of do anything. But that's not equanimity speaking, that's really, you know, kind of numbness mm-hmm. dissociation speaking. Mm-hmm. So internal distress can go in both directions,
mm-hmm.
You know, toward like hyper-solidity of the self, and also in the sense of like, I'm trying to find myself again. You know, it could be in the like, oh, I actually need more consolidation.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Both of them will have to be, in a sense, stabilized in a solid sense of self that isn't bound up with narrative and distress,
mm-hmm.
in that way, you know. And that's the pathway through then to being able to open out more, to forget myself more, but in a way that's wholesome.
Mm-hmm.
You know. Yeah. Yeah, great.
I'm not sure how to frame this, but thinking of Pablo Testrillo with 1,000 eyes, and it's a metaphor for something.
Mm-hmm.
And I get that, but translating it into individual social action.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Can you say a little more about that?
I'm not sure it translates into individual social action.
Well,
right? That would be the point. But
generally, when we act, we're acting as individuals.
Right, that's the problem.
Mm.
So like, what if what Avalokiteshvara does is see the world through the eyes of one who doesn't divide beings from beings, you know? Then, like, let's say, you know, I could look at a conflict between two classes of beings. You know, and I could say, like, this class of beings tends to oppress that class in these exact ways. And so then there's a body of actions that respond to that, that seek to kind of uplift one entire class, you know, or contain the greed, hatred, and delusion of the other class. If I try to do that as an individual, first of all, as an individual, I'm not really powerful enough to individually move an entire class of beings. Like, the occasional person makes a good dent, but no one can solve that alone. But if I orient toward classes of beings, I will then understand myself as being embedded in the various classes of beings that I'm part of, and then understand that my individual actions are part of a collective.
Even though you're doing
thing.
It individually.
Right.
Part of something.
Because right.
We're sort of told, well, all you can do is what you do.
That's the perspective from the individuals.
Yeah.
Right. And that's.
But you still would be act. I mean, I can only act as myself, but I would see myself as part of.
Right. So
eyes.
What if your practice was to see yourself as part of that thing, and you did that so much that you started to forget or just marginalize the individual part, you know? So they're like there's some way that, let's say right now that I'm as a member of the privileged class called men in this country. Let's say that I'm trying to be a good member of that class. I'm trying to act ethically and et cetera, get educated about issues in relation to male privilege, et cetera, patriarchy. My individual actions to do that, however much I succeed or fail at that, doesn't put a dent in patriarchy, right?
Right.
But my actions as a representative of the larger class exist in relation to a conversation about classes of people. And therefore, you know, I do that and I'm visible and I make connections with others who want to do that. And it's still not the case that my individual actions will save anything other than they'll save the people that I'm directly in relationship with from being harmed by me if I'm successful at that. But, you know, my body in the crowd doing that has the potential, when conditions are ripe, when the karma ripens, and karma is ripening right now on this mm-hmm. particular one, you know, and God willing, it keeps ripening, mm-hmm. that the actions of those who are able to intend and act as righteously as they can shift the class experience rather than the individual experience. And so the individual is always happening. I still have my own experiences. We're in individual relationship. But if I zoom my perspective out, I don't have to think about the individual that much once I'm acting from a basic level of ethical clarity. I could turn my attention to how is the large class of beings operating. And then I might start to write and think and speak and be with others and be with others in groups all through the lens of being a member of a set rather than, rather than my individual actions being the place I put my focus. Yeah? Yeah. Yeah. I think it's really just a lens thing. It's a perspective thing.
Yeah.
You know, landscape painters are different from microscopic miniature painters. And if we want to talk about systemic demons, we have to be more landscape painters than miniature painters. At least some of the time. Yes.
When you were, the whole thing about non-self, I was thinking of something that that made a difference to me as I explore white privilege and privilege in general. That in my explorations, I learned that inherent in privilege is blindness and fragility. Mm-hmm. And so I'm thinking, so I show up and I know that I notice that I have privilege in some certain area. Mm-hmm. So I know that part of that is there's going to be an inherent blindness.
Yeah.
And so there's sort of, it seems like a non-self in that.
Because it's great,
not Lisa,
right?
Who's so blind.
Yeah.
It's, I have this privilege, and I didn't sign up for it. It's
right.
There.
Right.
And so therefore, I know I have some blindness.
Yeah.
And so I ask people, please show me.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And then also think it's the negativity bias.
Mm-hmm.
We tend to pay attention to our non-privilege, so we don't see our privilege so much.
Right? So much in revealing the implications of something like privilege. And yeah, you know, this is such a beautiful practice to say, you know, these demons are inherent in my position. So help me out with it. Like,
mm-hmm.
if you were a farmer and you came to me and you were like, you know, it's clear that everyone who farms in this valley has to deal with boll weevils, you know. I have boll weevils on my farm. How do you deal with them? And an experienced farmer might be like, oh, well, you do this or that, or this or that. It's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Because you're not personally identified with the land.
Yeah.
You're just like, well, yeah, all the land around here has boll weevils. You'd be like, well, all the whiteness around here contains blindness.
Yeah.
How do you deal with blindness? Someone
yeah.
just help me. And they're like,
help
oh.
me because I can't see what I can't see.
Yeah, well, you plant mint underneath the tomatoes. Like, you know, it's like, oh, you know, you read a bit of bell hooks and you know, listen to better music. And you're like, oh, let's do it. You know, it's so straightforward. The hinge of the whole thing and the thing that would, in a certain way, defuse the entire argument, it would actually disappear the argument, of course, is the practice of not taking it personally.
Yeah.
If you don't take it personally, there's nothing to fight about.
Mm-hmm.
There's just a communal effort to mature
mm-hmm.
as beings toward wisdom. And of course, if everyone wanted to mature as beings toward wisdom, we wouldn't be in this situation. So, you know, kind individuals and their friends do the best they can.
Mm-hmm.
Other thoughts here? Yeah, to end us, go ahead.
It's actually actually helpful. The frame, the movement frame, is super helpful for me because that is a much more tangible, for me and my work and my life, I
yeah.
can grok that in a way more than some aspects of Buddhism.
Yeah.
I can get that, like, we are greater than the sum of our parts. Like, that's
yeah.
how our movements work. And I can
yeah.
I can understand, like, you know, intersectionality and that
yeah.
everything tugs on everything else. And
yeah.
I can't do climate in isolation from racial justice or economic justice.
Yeah.
And so through that lens, actually, I get more of
yeah.
non-self
yeah.
in a Buddhist framework. So
yeah.
that's super helpful to me.
Yeah, you can't even do the individual without finding that it tugs on everything else, or everything tugs on it.
Right. And I think part of the self thing, like when you feel like yourself, because we're in this, like, what does it mean to feel like yourself? Like, I feel like myself today, it usually means you feel happy,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I mean, like, when you really, like, I really feel like myself today, it usually means, I mean, maybe I'm wrong for other people,
right.
but that means I feel good.
Right.
And so, for
but
me,
actually, like, I have a little headache right now. I get lots of headaches, so I actually quite feel like myself.
Right.
I don't like it,
right.
you know.
Right. But to tease apart that's about who your self is.
Yeah.
Like I feel a lot like myself when I'm in the street in a huge action, like
yeah.
that because I'm ecstatic because I can
yeah.
you know the movement concedes itself and I
yeah.
feel I'm moving the culture and everything like that. So I feel like myself.
Yeah.
But if I tease that apart from that being about like a self.
Yeah.
That I'm part of a greater,
right.
many, literally many-eyed, many-handed
absolutely.
Organism.
Absolutely.
That is hopefully shifting the culture.
Right.
And so that, if I can just step out of that, like, self, then it's when
yep.
this physical entity feels happy.
Yeah.
And
yeah,
it's not
yeah.
just about self.
Absolutely. The self that feels like itself when you're in the middle of the crowd at the action, what if that self is a singular identity called, you know, the collective of folks who organize around
yeah.
this charge at
yeah.
the moment?
Yeah.
Feels good in this moment.
Yeah.
Even if any particular individual has a headache or has
right.
to pee or
right.
doesn't quite agree with the speaker and is holding a different sign
right.
but is there for ironic
right.
reasons. Like, it actually doesn't matter
exactly.
in a certain way.
Exactly.
That is a self.
Yeah, exactly.
And then it becomes wonderful to be like, oh, I feel like myself, but not my separate individual.
Well, that's what people feel ecstatic at music concerts.
Yeah.
That's the one organism
yeah.
jumping together
right.
to your
totally.
Your sound,
yep.
some sound. So.
Right, actually it turns out that not feeling like a separate self actually feels really good.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and we
exactly.
seek that in all sorts of ways.
Exactly.
You know, some wholesome and some not.
Right.
Yeah. Right on. So we'll go on from there. Talk about movements and continue to talk about. In a sense, I'm really enjoying thinking about this stuff with you and hearing the responses, really wanting to understand more and more what it means in a certain way to be a faith-based activist in a Buddhist sense. What does it mean to bring the inquiry and understandings that Buddhism is so beautifully enunciates into contact with the intention for actual healing in the social body. So we'll go on from there. Thanks for being here. It's a pleasure sitting together. Sweet, cool spring evening. The offerings of your resources absolutely sustain the group to continue. Thank you for your generosity. The wooden box there is for that, or Allie at the desk, and see you soon or anywhere. Take good care.
Thank you, Sean.
Thank you.